City Book Awards lecture. A couple of pieces of business. If you have one of these, please do this to it. I'm doing it with you, so I won't hear it. Second is Lawrence's books are for sale at the corner bookstore in the Peluso Family Exhibition Gallery up front, and I believe Ms. Gornick will be happy to sign copies following the presentation. Okay? On the street in New York, Vivian Gornick heard an anguished cry. I have four uncurable diseases. You or I would probably walk on by, act like we hadn't heard. She went up to the man and said, the word is incurable. She'll tell you what he had to say. Vivian Gornick's writing often puts me in mind of E.B. White, and specifically the E.B. White of This Is New York, and I have no higher praise than that. For starters, there's the sheer joy of finding yourself in the company of what jazz musicians used to call a great stylist. That is someone with such command of her instrument that you don't even think about it, and who uses it to create something fresh and artistically meaningful. The Odd Woman in the City, her second book of memoirs, is partly an exploration of New York's language, culture, and geography, partly a meditation on friendship, sex, loneliness, and self-acceptance, or at least self-understanding. It's full of dry wit, and in places very, very funny. But above all, the book's an intense, quirky reflection on the streets and neighborhoods of Manhattan, as seen by an impassioned observer who fell in love with the place as an adolescent in the years just after World War II. She compares the streets of New York to those of Samuel Johnson's beloved London. On the street, she tells us, Johnson made his enduring observations. Here he found his wisdom. At one point, a friend complains to Gornick, you're romanticizing the street. Don't you know New York has lost 75% of its manufacturing base? New York isn't jobs, she says, it's temper. Most people are in New York because they need evidence in large quantities of human expressiveness. And they need it not now and then, but every day. That's what they need. Those who go off to the manageable cities can do with that. Those who come to New York cannot. A while ago, the Times had an article about a couple from Milwaukee or someplace like that, one of the manageable cities. They'd come to New York and found the perfect apartment, flooded with light, overlooking the trees around the Museum of Natural History. The story quoted the wife. I wasn't going to move to New York without a view, she said. I couldn't imagine looking out the window at another building. Vivian Gornick says, every night, when I turn the lights out in my 16th floor living room before I go to bed, I experience a shock of pleasure as I see the banks of lighted windows rising to the sky, crowding around me, and feel myself embraced by the anonymous ingathering of city dwellers. This swarm of human hinds, also hanging, anchored in space, is the New York design offering generic connection. The pleasure it gives soothes beyond all explanation. I love that paragraph. I treasure that paragraph, but I would argue that there is an explanation. I think the banks of lighted windows give pleasure because Vivian Gornick is the kind of woman who deserves to live in New York, mm-hmm. and she's the kind of writer who helps us understand why we deserve, and in some cases, why we need to live here, too. So please join me in welcoming her to this public.
Except that it's me talking, so that's enough New York, right? I'm writing a book now on rereading. It started because some months ago, well, last year, I can't remember now, a friend and I reread Howard Zinn, Ian Forster's Howard Zinn, a book I hadn't read since I was in college. We reread this book, and I was shocked to see the differences in the way I felt about it, what I saw, how I felt, why I felt, how culture had changed in all these 40 years since I had read it, and how I had changed. And I wrote this up. I just wrote this little piece up, and it went into the Times. And my editor, Farrar Straus, actually, the first time this ever happened, called me up and she said, that's a book. I said, what do you mean? She said, that act of rereading is something everybody loves. And you did it with art. You know, I was really paying real attention to what I was reading. So I took her up on it, and I decided I would agree to that I would write a book in which, well, let me back up a minute. Italo Calvino, great Italian writer, said, a classic is a book that has never finished saying what it has to say. Right? It actually says it all, right? And I said to him, and so is a life, ideally. A life that stays alive until it dies, and it should never stop figuring out what it has to say. So I thought I would reread in this way. I'd like to write a book in which demonstrates how living and rereading reflect on each other, right? So now this is really a work in progress. I have here 18 pages that are the first pages that I feel, and I don't know where they'll go or how they'll end up. These are the first pages in which I felt I could go out into the world and sort of take a look at where I'm heading and what I'm doing. This is truly work in progress, and I truly invite you all to comment on what track you think I'm on, whether I'm on the right track, whether there's a sufficient sense of balance, whether the thing hangs together, okay? All right, we're in this together. So here I am, I'm gonna read these 18 pages, which have taken me like 6 months to get anywhere near. A formative experience in my life occurred the day I was then 20 years old and a student at CCNY. An English teacher put into my hands Sons and Lovers. You all know what that novel is, Sons and Lovers by T.H. Lawrence. I was a working class kid. There were no female protagonists in the books I read. And until then, I'd never heard the term coming of age novel. But I knew one when I saw one. And Paul Morel, the hero, his emotional struggle to leave home put the matter so starkly and so dramatically that even at that tender age, I felt myself communing with the primitive conflict at the heart of the tale. I read the book in one gulp, came back to class in trance, and from that day forward, Sons and Lovers was biblical text. It was as though I had had a conversion experience. From here on in, I knew literature with a capital L was to be my book of wisdom. It was to literature that I would turn to understand what I was living through and what I was to make of it. I read Sons and Lovers 3 times within the next 15 years, and with each reading, I identified with another of the characters. The first time it was Miriam, the farmer's daughter with whom Paul loses his virginity. I got her immediately. She sleeps with him not because she wants to, but because she fears losing him. During intercourse, her terror is such that instead of yielding to the experience, she lies beneath Paul, lost to his own sexual delirium, thinking, does he know it's me? Does he know it's me? Miriam's primary need is to know that she is desired and for herself alone. The dilemma was devastating. I felt the heat, the fear, the anxiety engulfing each of these two, but most especially, I felt it as though I was Miriam herself. I was 20 years old. I needed what she needed. The next time I read the book, I was Clara, the working class woman who is sexually passionate, wants to engage with erotic life, but still is alive to the potential for humiliation hidden in her need to feel that it is she who is being desired, and again, for herself alone. The third time I read the book, I was in my early 30s. Now, twice married, twice divorced, newly liberated, quote unquote. And I identified with Paul himself. Now preoccupied with desiring rather than being desired, I gloried in giving myself up to the shocking pleasure of sexual experience itself. Rich, full, transporting. At last, I was the hero of my own life. Only, of course, I wasn't. My point here is only that for me, this particular rite of passage, the fraught discovery of the joy, the misery, the awe, making oneself vulnerable to passion, was permanently sealed into the continued rereading of a great novel that repeatedly seemed to mirror my own gathering development, at the same time that its influence as a work of art broadened and deepened, filling me with wonder again and again at the intimate connection between life and literature. The illusion of self-mastery that comes with ecstatic sex is just that, an illusion. But for however long, sex outside of marriage had been one of Western civilization's strongest prohibitions, that illusion retained power of an almost mythical order. When I was a girl in the 1950s, the culture was still joined at the hip to the restraints of bourgeois life, which only fed the dream of transcendence interwoven with the promise of self-discovery wrapped around the astonishment of sexual passion. How's that for something? Except for one vital difference between then and now. Then we didn't call it sex, we called it love. And the whole world believed in love. My mother, a communist and a romantic, said to me, "You're smart, make something of yourself, but always remember love is the most important thing in a woman's life." Across the street, Grace Levine's mother, a woman who lit candles on Friday night and was afraid of everything that moved, whispered to her daughter, "Don't do like I did, marry a man you love." Around the corner, Elaine Goldberg's mother slipped her arm into a Persian lined coat and shrugged, "It's just as easy to fall in love with a rich man as a poor man." But her voice was bitter, precisely because she too believed in love. It was a working class immigrant neighborhood in the Bronx. Our lives might be small and frightened, but in the ideal life, it was felt, the educated life, the brave life, the life out in the larger world, love would not only be pursued, it would be achieved. And once achieved, transform existence, create a rich, deep textured prose out of the inarticulate recourse of inner life we daily passed on to one another. The promise of love alone gave us the courage to imagine leaving these caution-ridden precincts in order to turn our faces outward toward genuine experience. In fact, it was only if we gave ourselves over to romantic passion, that is love, without stint and without contractual assurance, would we have experience. We knew this because we too had been reading Anna Karenina and Emma Bovary and The Age of Innocence all our lives, as well as the 10,000 middlebrow versions of those books, and the dime store novels coming up just behind them. In literature, good and great writers, as well as mediocre popularizers, had sounded depths of emotion that made readers feel the life within themselves in the presence of words written to celebrate the powers of love. There might, of course, be a price to pay. One might be risking the shelter of respectability, even in the 1950s, if one fell in love with the wrong person. And don't forget, Emma and Anna did end up suicides. But no matter, the only truth for us was the power of feeling these heroic figures generated through their courage to risk all for passion. Like everyone else reading Sons and Lovers in mid-20th century, and by everyone else I mean the educated common reader, my contemporaries and I experienced the book as an essence of this conviction that to know oneself through the senses was to arrive at the very heart of human existence. It's interesting to realize now that while we thought we were contemplating passion as an instrument of some higher plane of achieved life, in fact, we really were seeking it as a goal in itself. No one ever had a word to say about what happened afterwards. That's why when the movie ended with the lovers riding off into the sunset, we all walked out of the theater feeling vindicated. In another but related vein, upon rereading Sons and Lovers, I also found each time around that I'd gotten much in the book itself wrong. This was actually a common experience, it is to this day, rereading this or that book that has been important to me throughout the years, and repeatedly finding that a narrative I'd long thought memorized was being called into startling question. It would appear that I'd gotten this or that character or this or that plot turn wrong. They met here in New York, I thought it was Rome. The time was 1870, I was sure it was 1900. The mother did what to the protagonist? And I can never help marveling. If I got this wrong, and this wrong, how come the book still has me in its grip? When I came to reread Sons and Lovers recently, in, shall we say, my advanced maturity, it wasn't so much that I found I'd gotten many of the details wrong, which I had, but rather that my memory of the Oedipal theme of sexual passion as the central experience of a life was wrong. That, I now saw, wasn't really what the book was about, and I found it all the greater and the more moving that I had held it close to my heart all these years for a set, not of misinformed, but insufficiently informed reasons. The psychological complexity of the novel, which had eluded me, now seemed only to have been waiting for me to grow into the understanding it required of its readers. Set at the turn of the 20th century, in a mining village in the English Midlands, Sons and Lovers tells the story of the Morells and their four children. Gertrude, a school teacher of romantic sensibility, and Walter, a fun-loving miner, had met at a dance. She drinks in the 1880s. She drawn by his good looks, his gaiety, and his talent for dancing, while he in turn is drawn by her responsiveness to his sensuality. They develop a passion for each other and they marry. He promises her a house of her own, a good enough income, and tender fidelity. Soon enough, she discovers that on none of these can he deliver. Quote, "He had no grit," she said bitterly to herself. What he felt just at the minute, that was all to him. He could not abide by anything. There was nothing at the back of all his show, end quote. He, in turn, is startled to find that she cannot bear disappointment well. It turns her bitter and austere. In no time at all, he, bewildered by the constant sense of accusation he now feels at home, escapes to the pub every chance he gets. 8 years down the road, when the book begins, Mrs. Morell is now 31 years old, pregnant with her third child, living in undreamt of poverty, material and emotional, and repelled by her husband, whom she and the children along with her now experience only as a hard-drinking, violent lout. Lawrence loves the word lout. It appears many times in his book. As romantic sensibility does not desert Mrs. Morell, it is to her sons. The one daughter has no presence at all. It's to her sons that she inevitably turns for the kind of companionship required to feed a star in her life. At first, it is William, the eldest, of whom she hopes to make a soulmate. But it soon transpires that it is Paul, the second son and our protagonist, with whom she had really been destined to merge. From the very beginning, when he is still an infant in her lap, quote, "She felt strangely toward the infant. It seemed quite well, but she noticed the peculiar knitting of the baby's brows and the peculiar heaviness of its eyes, as if it were trying to understand something that was pain. Suddenly looking at him, the heavy feeling in the mother's heart melted into passionate grief. My lamb," she cried softly, end quote. Her soul's anxiety has entered into the babe. At the age of 3 or 4, he cries for no reason, grows melancholy for no reason, but the reader understands the reason. It's that from birth on, Paul and his mother had been as one. From that moment on, we know this is not exactly mother love at work here. These are the thoughts and feelings of a woman who sees her spiritual salvation joined at the hip to that of this boy, who, enthralled to his mother's adoration, will, as a teenager, declare that he will never leave her, but as he grows to young manhood, will ineluctably begin to discover that the life within is pulling him toward the kind of self-discovery that will demand he leave her behind, not because for a minute does he want to, but because she cannot follow where he's going. The life she has lived, the thoughts and feelings she has not had, will not permit it. The metaphor Lawrence uses for Paul's wrenching dilemma is, of course, erotic love. As Paul's need for it grows, and the two women, Miriam and Clara, become the instruments of his awakening and initiation, he delves ever deeper into its extraordinary force until he finds that passion has the ability to mimic liberation, but not actually deliver it. The struggle, not between Paul and his mother, but between Paul and the illusion of liberating sex, is the spine of the novel. It was this last that I had always failed to register, along with the rest of the world. And the characters were far more complicated than I had remembered. In the very first pages of the book, while she is still pregnant with Paul, Lawrence writes of Mrs. Morell, "She was sick of it, the struggle with poverty and ugliness and meanness. She went into the garden feeling too heavy to take herself out, yet unable to stay indoors. And looking ahead, the prospect of her life made her feel as if she were buried alive. What am I to do with it, she said to herself. What am I to do with all this? Even the child I'm going to have, it doesn't seem as if I were taken into account." This was a speech I did not at all recall, It sounded more like a woman speaking in 1970 than in 1910. I had thought of Mrs. Morell as a rather one-dimensional person, a tight-lipped woman whose obsessive involvement with her own betrayed dreams of life had deprived her of perspective. But there she is, conscious of a self that, in the midst of the endless quotidianness in her life, she knows is missing. And right here begins the separating out of what I now saw was the larger piece of understanding that underlay Lawrence's insistence on the primacy of the sensual. Then there's Morell himself. I remembered him as a Caliban, but he's only a childish man whose gift, his only gift, for innocent sensuality had been steadily eroded by the lack of the very thing that could have made him a better person, a sympathetic partnership. In his youth, he'd been a great dancer with a love of music embedded in a heart that yearned to be light. And even now, going off to work in the mines, he tied a scarf around his neck, put on his great heavy boots, his coat with a big pocket that carried his snapback and his bottle of tea, and went forth into the fresh morning air. He loved the early morning and the walk across the fields. So he appeared at the pit top, often with a stalk from the hedge between his teeth, which he chewed all day long to keep his mouth moist, down the mine, feeling as happy as when he was in the fields. That took me by surprise. He was a good workman, dexterous, and one who, when he was in a good humor, always sang. He had whole periods, months, almost years of friction and nasty temper. Then sometimes he was jolly again. It was nice to see him run with a piece of red hot iron into the scullery, crying, "Out of my road, out of my road." Then he hammered the soft red glowing stuff on his iron goose and made the shape he wanted. Then the children watched with joy. Morell, too, has been left crying in the wilderness. His head is filled with chaos because he is a sentient creature who cannot say to himself, "Where am I in all this?" It is precisely his inarticulateness that makes it hard for him to come straight home after work, which in turn leaves his wife, although she now hates the sight of him, doubly trapped in the misery of normalcy outrage. She sat alone, on the hob, the saucepan steam, the dinner plate lay waiting on the table. All the room was full of the sense of waiting, waiting for the man who was sitting in his pit dirt, dinnerless, some mile away from home, across the darkness, drinking himself drunk, persisting in his dirty and disgusting ways, just to assert his independence. They loathed him. They loathed him. Cannot be repeated often enough in this book. On page 3, Mrs. Morell hates Morell. On page 5, she holds him in contempt. On page 8, she loathes him. But it starts all over again. And these repetitions go on for most of the novel. For a book devoted to love, the unremitting rage flung down on page after page is sobering. Yes, they loathed him. But they also were him. Paul would rather scrape the skin off his body than admit to any shared characteristic. But, and this I certainly did not remember, he is actually as moody and thin-skinned as his father. At 14, he, quote, was full of life and warm. Then his smile came suddenly and was very lovable. But when there was any clog in his soul's quick running, his face went stupid and ugly. He was the sort of boy that becomes a clown and a lout as soon as he is not understood or feels himself held cheap, and again is adorable, the first touch of warmth. Somewhere within himself, Paul must have known that all sensuous feeling in him, tender or murderous, ever ready to burst the skin, came from Morell. But if he had let himself think about it, it would have made him ill. So Lawrence doesn't make him think about it. He allows us to. The reader to do it. And then there's William. William, whom I had forgotten completely, the oldest son. William, whose outcome is perhaps the most telling of all. William had the soul of an accountant. Absorbed in his white-collar job in London, which he expects will bring him money and a rise in social status, he quite cheerfully comes home less and less, as children bent on making their way in the city do. But one Christmas, still in his early 20s, he brings home Lily, a secretary to whom he has engaged himself. She is beautiful, and he is besotted with her. at the same time that he seems permanently irritated by her because she is in fact vain and stupid. And now that he sees her through his mother's eyes, gets horribly on his nerves. Torn apart by the conflict within himself, William quarrels with Lily at the drop of a hat, instantly regrets his bad behavior, then lets his head fill once again with blood. He repented, kissed and comforted the girl. But in the evening, after supper, he stood on the hearthrug while she sat on the sofa, and he seemed to hate her. The mother goes into shock when she sees what's happening to William. That's how it seems to her. It's happening to him, as in a Greek tragedy. She raked the fire. Her heart was heavy now as it had never been. Before, with her husband, things seemed to be breaking down in her, but they did not destroy her power to live. Now her soul felt lame in itself. She herself had been lured into marriage by sexual attraction, but this sort of desperation, the sort that comes with desire being made conscious, no one of her generation had ever seen. She immediately recognized it as world-shattering, as does William himself. His hunger for Lily is hateful to him. It humiliates him and drives him to act in ways that he himself holds in contempt. He knows that Lily is guilty of nothing more than being herself, yet he cannot refrain from heaping blame on her for his own wretchedness. In a burst of despair he cannot control, he cries out to his horrified mother that should he die, Lily would forget him in a week. That's how shallow she is. Just to read the words on the page is to see the torment writ large on William's face. How could I have forgotten this? Passion, passion, passion. Hard, mean, racking. Neither sensual nor romantic, only boiling. Passion that is more like war than love. The rawness behind the longing for sexual ecstasy. The depth of its anguish. The fear of ruination. The consequence that can never be undone. This alone was enough to persuade whole civilizations of the primacy of erotic need. It is a stark and unforgiving look we have here at the price sexual hunger exacts from a life being lived in near Victorian times. Inescapably, I found myself remembering all those mediocre novels about marriage being written at the same time by H.G. Wells, novels at which the same conflict is often at the heart of the narrative. A working class boy who wants to rise in the world, but meanwhile is perishing for want of his sexual life, and talks himself into marrying the first girl who seems willing to lie down with him if only he will marry her. Invariably, the protagonist in these novels feels dread at committing himself to such a marriage, but the dread loses out to the killing need. It's a situation Wells knows from the inside out. Any reader can understand what he's talking about, but his writing is not up to making us feel anguished by the void being looked into while standing on that particular brink. It is Lawrence, whose few pages on William and Lily are penetrating. William is a figure much more like a Wells protagonist than he is like his brother Paul, but it is on his behalf that Lawrence makes us shudder, because what he sees everywhere and in everyone. That's how a novelist builds a world. And this I had completely gone by me. Luckily, I was too young, really, to grasp this. Luckily, William dies not long after the benighted Christmas visit, and it will be left to Paul to sort it all out. It is through him that Lawrence will investigate exactly how much devotion, either to the flesh or the spirit, is required to address what I now saw as the not open, but underlying concern of sons and lovers. How to construct a self from the inside out. Poor Miriam, and again, this I didn't remember at all. Also, she also craves a life that will turn on having herself. What a bum rap she gets in this book. Miriam is 16 when she and Paul meet. As he says, brown-eyed, black curl, beautiful. Inclined toward religion because, and as it has been for millions of women before and after, it is the only text available that lifts her from the grubby claustrophobia of an existence whose horizons are right up against her face. Lawrence sees her situation plainly, but cannot afford to give her the sympathy that might make of her our more central character than he needs her to be. So he gives it to us like this. She was, like such women, has treasured religion inside them. Breathe it in their nostrils and see the whole of life in a mist thereof. She loved tremblingly and passionately when a tremendous sunset burned out the western sky, or sat in her bedroom aloft alone when it snowed. That was life to her. For the rest, she drudged in the house, quivered in anguish from the vulgarity of those around her and from the common sounding voice of the curate and her brothers, who were brutal louts. She hated her position as swine girl. She wanted to be considered. She wanted to learn. If she could read, the world would have a different face for her and a deepened respect. Her beauty, that of a shy, wild, quaveringly sensitive thing, seemed nothing to her. Even her soul was not enough. She must have something to reinforce her pride, because she felt different from other people. This sense of difference in Miriam is for Lawrence a double-sided coin. Paul shrinks from the religiosity, but when he sees her in church, quote, his soul stirred within him, a lot of souls, because she seemed something more wonderful, less human, something he could not get to. It is interesting and somewhat painful to see this inchoateness in Miriam is treated with suspicion, while the same, actually much worse inchoateness in her brothers, these wild, hard-working farmhands, whom Miriam and her mother are constantly trying to symbolize through scripture, is analyzed with equanimity. Although these boys, quote, resented so bitterly the eternal appeal to their deeper feelings that the mother, yet it had an effect on them. Ordinary folk seemed shallow to them, trivial, inconsiderable, and so they were painfully uncouth in the simplest social intercourse, suffering and yet insolent in their superiority, just like Mary. Then beneath was the yearning for the soul intimacy to which they could not attain because they were too dumb, and every approach to close connection was blocked by their clumsy contempt of other people. They wanted genuine intimacy, but they could not get even normally near to anyone because they scorned to take the first steps. They scorned the triviality which forms common human intercourse. These were sentiments Lawrence held with alternating scorn and compassion throughout his life, sentiments he feared applied to himself as well as to the people among whom he grew. Thus, for his own purpose as a writer, he loved, hated, and exploited the Miriams, but could neither give nor deny them their due. Instead, he lets Paul Morel drive himself crazy over this dilemma. Hence, in one paragraph, there was the most intense pleasure in talking about his work to Miriam. All his passion, all his wild blood went into this intercourse with her when he talked and conceived his work. She brought forth to him his imagination. But then Miriam's intensity, which would leave no emotion on a normal plane, irritated him into a frenzy. Why can't you laugh, he said. You never laugh laughter. You only laugh when something is odd or incongruous. And then it always seems to hurt you. When you laugh, I could cry. It seems as if it always shows up your suffering. Oh, you make me knit the brows of my very soul. And I'm so damn spiritual with you always. And I don't want to be spiritual. Then, stricken by his own evil behavior, he sees her with, quote, her soul, naked in her great dark eyes, and there was the same yearning appeal upon her. This habit of Lawrence's of making the character suffer two and even three reversals of judgment in the space of a single paragraph is a vivid presence in Sons and Lovers. It not only signifies the instability of our moods, it nails the torment at the heart of any decision rooted in mixed emotions. It also became one of the literary moves most referred to when readers spoke of the new form he was creating in this novel, which was published in 1913. I don't know, I've got to tell you that. There's much to be said on form here, but I'm not going to say it tonight. At last, Paul persuades Mary to lie down with him. Possession, he tells her, is a great moment in life. All strong emotions are concentrated there. And of course, it's a disaster. They fuck for a week, but after each episode, each is left feeling alone. Alone and in despair. We don't know what Miriam is going through, but Paul, he had always, almost willfully, to act from the brute strength of his own feelings, and he could not do it often. There remained afterwards always the sense of failure and of death. If he were really with her, he had to put aside himself and his desire. If he would have her, he had to put her aside. In a sense, Lawrence does for Miriam what Hardy, with infinitely more sympathy, does for Sue Bridehead and Jude the Obscure. They both bring her to complicated life, the heart, Sue and Miriam, then sacrifice her to a lover's demand that inevitably makes of her the instrument of his need, superficially fulfilled, essentially denied. You don't want to love, Paul raves at Miriam. Your eternal and abnormal craving is to be loved. You absorb, as if you must fill yourself up with love because you've got a shortage somewhere. Exactly what his mother, for her own reasons, thinks of Miriam. She's not an ordinary woman who can lead me at my share in him. She wants to absorb him. She wants to draw him out and absorb him till there's nothing left of him. She will suck him up. So incredibly self-absorbed are both Paul and Mrs. Morell. The possibility that Miriam is laboring under the same blindsided narrowness that hinders each of them, this is beyond them. Nevertheless, our hearts do not bleed for Miriam as they do for Sue Bridehead, because Lawrence doesn't love her as Hardy loves Sue. In fact, Lawrence doesn't love anybody. I finally came to realize, and now recall, that W.H. Auden had once said of him, quote, on the forces of hatred and aggression, he is a master. Of affection and human charity, he knows absolutely nothing, which was all true. And here, I'd like to digress a bit through Sue Bridehead, who will not belong in these pages, but I just realized all this, so I put it in. Sue Bridehead, the female protagonist of Jude the Obscure, to make a point about living and rereading. When we first meet Sue, she is bent on becoming a Janice Gaethje. She's bent on becoming a new woman of her moment. She and June meet up, and she quickly becomes his mentor. They're both country people, now finding themselves in the nearest big city, instructing him that together they must struggle to live freely and honestly without bending to the shibboleths of religion or social convention, by which she also daringly means marriage. He's delighted with this idea and has the inner strength to try to follow through. However, Sue turns out to be intellectually brave, but emotionally frail. Her anxieties make her not only sexually dysfunctional, in the goodness of 400 of the most agonizing pages in English literature, but she undergoes the worst experiences a woman can have, now as then. Sue reverts to religious mania, goes half insane, and is persuaded that she must pay and pay and pay for having outraged the gods. The first time I met Sue, I was in college. I liked and admired her immensely, but couldn't fathom the sexual frigidity. I was horrified by the manic regression into religiosity. The second time I encountered her, I was 10 years older, had just had an illegal abortion, and to my own dismay, was experiencing an apprehension I found shocking. Somewhere deep inside, in a place I could not put a name to, I was experiencing fear of retribution. One day on the street, the words formed themselves in my head, for this you will be punished. I went upstairs, took Jude the Obscure off my bookshelf, and turned to the sections on Sue's religious mania. And it was then that, for the very first time in my life, I began to see what a primitive issue abortion is, an act capable of inducing existential dread in the most unlikely of people. All this I could see and feel through Sue, because Hardy's sympathy for her runs so deep. Lawrence's Miriam, on the other hand, never really becomes flesh and blood, because he does not let us see and feel her as she might see and feel herself. Nevertheless, after this last reading, I realized I would never see Miriam the same again. Etta Clark, a working class feminist of the 1880s, who has had enough education and experience so that she too feels herself to be different. Unlike Miriam, Clara is possessed of a haughty reserve that makes her seem mysterious and exciting, even though she's a mass of enervating contradiction, hungry for life yet fearful and suspicious of all who approach her. Nevertheless, she falls for Paul and she sleeps with him. With Clara, he finally knows the rapture of sex, and with Clara, they are drinking together. It is here in bed with her that his separation from adolescence, he's now 23, is completed, and the alarming complexity of life as it is begins to take hold of him. When at last Paul and Clara lie down together, the love they make is not only rapturous, the earth moves. Quote, and after such an evening, they both were very still, having known the immensity of passion, childish and wondering like Adam and Eve, when they lost their innocence and realized the magnificence of the power which drove them out of paradise and across the great night and the great day of humanity. To know the tremendous living flood which carried them always gave them rest within themselves. If so great a magnificent power could overwhelm them, identify them all together with itself, so that they knew they were only grains in the tremendous heave that lifted every grass blade to its little height and every tree and living thing, then why fret about themselves? They could let themselves be carried by life. It was a verification that they had had together. Nothing could nullify it. Nothing could take it away. A mere few months and 10 pages later, quote, Clara knew this held her to her, so she trusted altogether to the passion. It, however, had begun to fail her. They did not often reach again the height of those times when they experienced the oceanic. Gradually, some mechanical effort spoiled their loving, or often he seemed merely to be running on alone. Often they realized it had been a failure, not what they had wanted. One night, he left her, knowing that evening had only made a little split between them. Their loving grew more mechanical, without the marvelous glamour. Within the year, they had parted. It is passages like these two that mark the modernity of the book. Modernity was pushing all writers to put on the page at the turn of the 20th century. To put on the page the entire truth of whatever it was the writer found festering in the human psyche. Not only sorrow and disorder, but sadism, alienation, and the brevity of passion. I now think that Lawrence saw this last by the time Sons and Lovers was published. He was then 27 years old, but it couldn't stack up against the pressure of that other thing that he also saw, and that was to be his life's obsession. That to be deprived of experience of the senses, as bourgeois society demanded we be, was truly a sin against life. Lawrence didn't know any more than Hardy did on this score, or H.G. Wells, or George Meredith, for that matter, grown-up writers all. It was simply the heat with which he insisted on outing what they all knew but could not address directly that set him apart. He was like an abolitionist among anti-slavery liberals who say, yes, slavery is terrible, but in time it'll die out, be patient. While the abolitionist says, fuck that, now or never, and goes to war. It was this in Lawrence that F.R. Lee, this great literary critic, called being, quote, disturbed enough by life to come to greatness. We should all want to write a sentence like that. And it was true. To feel badly but calmly about what is spiritually deforming is the mediocre norm. To rage against it is to become an instrument of revolutionary change. And in literature, one does that by naming the crime against nature without pity or caution or euphemism, renouncing in no uncertain terms, as Auden had it, quote, the laziness or fear which makes people prefer secondhand experience to the shock of looking and listening for themselves. because Lawrence did nothing but look and listen for himself, Levis placed him in his great tradition among those writers he considered to be endowed with marked moral intensity. Within the next 5 years, Lawrence wrote his two acknowledged masterpieces, The Rainbow and Women in Love. He said when he started them that he would not again write the way he did in Sons and Lovers, graphically and with transparency. No, now he would make what he felt dense with meaning, wild and large and mythic, and so forth. Nevertheless, both novels are hard to read these days. So packed are they with a violence of spirit that I for one find oppressive, and a shocking amount of the polemic to which Lawrence became ever more addicted. In these books, he certainly had got the crime of suppressed feeling down brilliantly. This is where his genius succeeds without parallel. But the part that promises surcease from human anxiety through erotic freedom, there I now feel him wringing his hands in these novels, the prose in a fever, because he suspects that what he insists is true may not in fact be true. Lawrence was writing at the beginning of the 14th century, living in a time that was just on the verge of putting center stage what he himself was grappling with. His metaphor, in fact, was to become the wedge that modernism used to pry open the uncharted territory of human consciousness. If Lawrence were alive today, this metaphor would not be available to him, because today all have had long experience of the sexual freedom once denied and have discovered firsthand that the making of a self from the inside out is not to be achieved through the senses alone. In fact, it will turn out that not only does sexual ecstasy not deliver us to ourselves, one must have a self already in place to know what to do with it should it come. Yet the need to feel alive within oneself is incontestable. Nothing can replace or reduce or destroy it. In our time, we've come to understand that that inner aliveness comes not as a gift or an act of magic or the luck of the draw. It is something earned through a long, hard slog into the interior, one made without a map or even a flashlight, equipped only with the urgency of one's need. To see embedded in Sons and Lovers the insights about that urgency that would blossom into cultural truth not only in a half century but in our half century makes the novel truly as exciting to read today as it must have been on the day it was published. Thank you. I don't really know because I have those in my mind because I can see them stringing out from this, but I can't say any more.
Yes, well, I was embarrassed at how much I had forgotten about Sons and Lovers.
Oh, good. So,
but I have to say the best line I thought was when you were describing your friend Mother.
Oh.
I mean, that is just right, so that was great.
That's the way it was.
I know.
Renunciation was the name of the game. Everyone is renouncing everything in the name of honor or this or that. When in fact, now you read it and you see clearly it's sexual repression. It's fear. It's fear. It's fear of undergoing actual experience, and then what do you do with it? The Age of Innocence was a great romance for me. If you know that, you know the novel. Yeah. So you know, Newbold Archer has to give her up. He has to give up Ellen Lansky. He has to give her up for a deadline, for nothing. But in fact, what the great novels did show, Anna Karenina, Emma Bovary, all those, and Edith Wharton in her own much smaller way, because those were great, great novels. Tolstoy, nothing beats Anna Karenina because she gives up, right? She gives up the security of her dead life. It's not a dead life, it's a life without feeling. It's a life in which she cannot feel herself. She gives it all up for feeling. And then what happens? She and Vronsky, they get tired of each other. All they have really is chemistry. What they have is the power of sexual repression, which explodes, they act on it, then they have to run away, they have to go into exile. So then they're on perpetual vacation. They're out of their lives, they have nothing to do, there's nothing to do. And Tolstoy minds this greater than any other writer ever before says. It is one of the great works of the world because they could then take that metaphor of sexual repression, they could take that metaphor and make it stand in for so much in the human condition because it was alive. It was alive with endless nuance. He could look deeply into it and let us see the meaning of those failures. Now, nobody can write a book like that today. Now, I'll tell you this. Colette, who's also a writer, whom I and my girlfriends at City College, me and my friends, we adore Colette. When I was 22 years old, she was really the fountain of wisdom on the addiction of erotic love. She did the same thing. She did what no woman before her had done, no writer before had done, except for Tolstoy. She put a woman in love at the center of the work, as though it was as important as war or religion or nature or anything, right? In other words, what was happening inside a woman in love was made into a ring. Now you reread Colette today, and it seems much smaller than it seemed when I was a girl. Unlike this, this seems different, but not smaller, because he is the greater. And so there are things, even though the metaphor is for me, for all of us, slightly ridiculous, right? Look what he says after they just, they just went to bed. And the earth moves, it's all, they're Adam and Eve, they're out of paradise. It's not too likely that most people will feel that today. It's good to inspect what you do feel. But you can't make that kind of metaphor work anymore. We all just have too much experience. But a great writer has minded so that he's seen things in the human condition out of looking at that, that makes it those great novels. Age of Innocence is still a marvelous book because it's a story for her almost as for them. But as I say, when we read it as girls, it was like the crusade, romantic love. The fact that it failed, the fact that they all died, the fact that it was suicide, that didn't matter. When we read Colette, we actually thought that to have a passion like the one she was indicating was more than enough. It was life itself. If we could have that, it didn't matter. No. So I look at it now, and I look for what is intelligent in it, and why it still resonates, and I will put that down to my own live life. Yes?
I approach this very warily because I'm not sure I know what I'm talking about, but you did say that you didn't think that D.H. Lawrence felt anything for anybody. Did you say that?
Well, it's often been said of him, he did not love people. And in fact, in his actual life, in his actual person, in almost every memoir Shane's ever written about him, he is seen as a man of hard and boiling passions, but not exactly love. In other words, it is through people that he has to, or we can't, we only can know everything we know through other people, right? If you're not understanding me.
I think he built a good case for that, a lot of the novels. I wondered about his poetry. And his
poetry,
poem,
he loves that
poem in which he lays his hand on the woman, I think it's his wife, next to him, and like Gabriel in the dead, realizes that her separateness, her autonomy as a real separate human being.
For a moment.
You're only going to get it.
His great poetry is really
kind of
about animals. His great, you reread all his poetry,
yes.
If you want to reread his poetry,
yes.
Or read it, you will see, again, Orton has written brilliantly on this, all the great poetry is this astonishing feeling for animals through which he feels the wonder of existence. Much less, yes, a little bit with the wife, but in actuality, their marriage was incredibly turbulent, full of insult and injury. I just recently read a little memoir by Frieda's daughter, his wife's daughter. She describes how, when she grew up, she began to spend time with them. Wherever they went, she would come to meet them, in Italy, in all the different places in France and in America, all the places they traveled. They traveled endlessly. They were incredibly restless. There was no home. There was no way for him to feel at home anywhere. They were always on the move. It was a long life of them, like nomads, self-imposed exile. And she describes a couple of months she spends with them in Italy, in which they quarrel so violently, and he is so bad. She says to him, Frieda runs out crying, as she did constantly, do you care for her at all? And he's stunned by the directness of that question, and he blusters the way a man would bluster. Do you know what I've done for your mother? But that was the reality, and it's all right, it didn't matter, because it was a strength of feeling, feeling good or bad, feeling, as I say, tender or murderous, that is and always ready to burst the skin, that's in his books, especially Women in Love, especially.
I have another question. Yeah. Do you think there are books that you really should be a certain age to read?
Oh, absolutely.
Like I was thinking about Catherine Bigelow, maybe the 1 in 15,
yeah.
So you might appreciate it. Like,
I'm not going to reread that.
So what books are best to read when you're getting older?
Well, only you can decide that. But like I said, so I described a vital moment when I came upstairs and I knew what I had to read.
Yeah.
I knew what would be good. We all know that instinctively. We all reach for the books we need when we need. There are books on your shelves that will stand there for 20 years and all of a sudden you feel compelled, you don't know why, to read it, but you know why. I mean, something in you knows why. I do believe strongly in that. And I would like that to underline this book, this sense of things. In fact, Elizabeth Bowen is a writer whom I read in advance, not when I was a girl, but when I was an adult already. And now I've reread her when I'm more than an adult. I've been an adult for a long time. And I see more clearly than I ever could before. Those extra 30 years between the time I first read her and now were necessary for me to see her as clearly as I do now. I believe in that. If I can capture that, I'll be happy.
I recently reread To the Lighthouse.
Huh?
And I found it. So it felt self-conscious to me. I kept thinking about me instead of To the Lighthouse, and
yeah.
When I had read it before. What advice do you have for someone who's about to be me?
I have no advice.
None?
No. Well, what?
Zero?
Advice. I don't give advice. I give examples. Haven't I given examples?
Yeah.
You can only, you read a book and then you read it again and it doesn't speak to you. You go find the book that does speak to you, in which you do get lost. consciousness or consciousness to your critics.
Right.
Right.
And who, what?
Well, here I am.
What literary critics do you reread?
Only me. who do I reread? I read Randall Jarrell. I read Delmo Schwartz. I read, I just recently, Auden all the time. Auden is not failing in his value and his pleasure and his wisdom. These are people who read and write the way I want to read and write. This is in the humanist tradition, which is not popular today, which is not current. When I was growing up, when you were growing up, the great critics were all great literary humanists. Irving Howe, Kaysen, Delmo Schwartz, all these people, only from the New York Art Manager, the people of that generation, they wrote criticism the way we read, if you know what I mean. It was all the same language.
I have to add Edna Wilson.
Edna Wilson, absolutely Edna Wilson. Thank you, I just forgot. Yeah. Edna Wilson, absolutely, I reread him. It is a pain to me that I can't add women to this list. I probably could, I'm hardly the most educated or cultivated of writers or critics, hardly. Though, so there are people who probably have a string of names that I can't supply, but you get the idea of what I'm talking about. Most critics today are not critics in that great tradition, and their issues and their values are often not mine. I'm a critic myself, and I value the act of adding a layer of consciousness to the act of reading. Oh, Mr. Peter?
There's some great books you've reread and discovered that you pretty much got it right the first time. They haven't changed that much for you?
Not yet. Yes.
Did you read Colette in French or in English?
No, in English.
But it might have changed your mind, perhaps, if you're better in French.
You think so?
I do. Yeah. I do. I think the language is so extraordinary.
French. Yes, I know that.
And that you didn't discuss. I understand that's not part of what you're discussing tonight. However, it's really puts her in a very special place, I think. And the language in French imparts something that perhaps doesn't quite come through in the translation.
That's possible. That is possible. But I did reread her 2 years ago, and I just found the whole, when I read her before, I felt a world. I felt myself in the midst of a world, the world. I felt the world was enlarging. That those horizons were spreading. This time around, they felt much closer in.
But it is a very narrow world. That's true, if you go to that.
And this time around, I like her husband, one of her husbands said, love, madam, is there nothing but love to write about? And at the time, it seemed absurd. The Vagabond, a book that I reread, was written in 1910, and in 1910, it came as, you know, a shock throughout Europe. In 1910, Andre Gide could write to her, "Madam, this is a perfect book. I have nothing to say." Yeah. I don't think anybody would read her today and feel that, or could possibly feel that. It does just feel a lot narrow. Now, I know you're right. Language can do a lot to rescue what seems small in one language and much larger in another. Joseph Brodsky is supposedly a great Russian poet. In English, he doesn't read great. So, be my guest. Read her in French and write something about it.
I have read her in French and I have not written about it.
Okay, I'll give it a shot. Yeah.
I wanted to tell you that I just finished The Odd Woman in the City and loved it today, but what's interesting is that my biggest takeaway from it was that I thought, I must start rereading. There were so many books that you mentioned you talked about the Hardy, you talked about Isabel Arthur and James, you talked about the relationship James had, and I started thinking about the way you were using those characters in this book, talking about your reflection on yourself as a woman
graduate students. They were graduate students, but they were all remarkably smart and responsive. And I had invited them to do what I've invited you to do. And one of them raised her hand, and I called on her. And then she said, she covered her face and said, "Ooh, I'm about to say something negative to Vivian Cornick."
No,
ridiculous. And I said, "Say it, say it." And she said, "There's not enough of the living part in this." So that's pretty much what you're saying. In other words, what I've said there, I had to find some variation on that in these readings. I mean, I realized reading this, well, this is my take, but I have to reflect properly the way in which I've made use of these books as I have there. And I do believe that's what has to happen in this.
And it will be wonderful, because it's all that's there, and it is.
Let's
so exciting to see someone talking about the different stages of adulthood. And also as a New Yorker, just the way in which New York itself is changing.
I always meant to use those books in relation to the city more than myself,
yes.
Right?
But yourself is very much
in friendship. Is a book that is never finished saying what it has to say. But that's exactly how it's a lineup over my desk now. It's what is guiding me. And I'm trying to make it reflective.
Say it again.
A classic is a book that never finishes saying what it has to say. So I like to make that, really solid. No. Think about it. That's not enough. Yes.
I'm wondering if when you read, I write in the book mine. I sometimes have conversations with the author. And when I reread, it's actually more
the margin in.
How I've grown past.
Right.
You know,
I don't do that anymore.
You don't.
No, but I do take notes.
Are
and I keep
reading
the notes.
What I was really asking is whether any of the stuff you're rereading is the original books that you read, and if you had notes or marginalia.
Oh, well, a lot of the books that have been on my shelves for a long time. Yes, but that marginalia, which is very useful in a lot of readings from a lot of great writers, have left marginalia of their own reading. But I never, when I read mine, it's like, how true. So no.
You identified sexual repression as one of the major themes of these masterpieces. Now, without sexual repression today,
what is that a problem? Well, I wrote a book called The End of the Novel of Love. It's a collection of pieces in which I reread these books from that, many books from that point of view, suddenly seeing in many things, and then I wrote the title essay to pull it all together, but in many books, I had seen the way in which the writer was using this theme of erotic love to make a book, and that it couldn't be done anymore. I used there, in the title essay, I used to make my point, a book by Jane Smiley, a writer whom I like and admire. She wrote a book called The Age of Grief. It's a novella. She wrote it about 20 years ago, I don't know how long ago. Anyway, it is a novella. It's a pair of people, a couple. They're 35 years old. They've been married for, I don't know, since they're in the 20s. They have three children. They're both dentists, God knows why. She makes the best. They're living in a small small American city. And it starts out with them. It's a cold winter night. They're driving home along this small, country road from a church where she has sung in an elaborate church spectacle of some sort. She can sing. She's all dressed up. She's full of makeup. She's sitting in the back seat with one of the girls. He's in the front with two of the other two. And she looks out the window into the dark, and she says to herself, well, she says out loud, "I will never forget. I will never be as happy as I am tonight." And he looks at her in the mirror, and he knows she's having an affair. And all he wants is that she not tell him. And what follows then is a winter in which these two live out, in which he struggles to keep this this life together. She and the girls all fall very ill with the flu. He turns out, of course, this solid citizen. He gets them through. He's a real mensch. And when they all recover, she does leave, and then she comes back. So the whole thing is, what the age of grief is the moment when they know their lives are never going to be any larger than they are at this moment. That is the age of grief. And it usually does happen, they say, in mid-30s, when people have been married and had children since they were in their 20s, and there they are. Nothing will ever be any larger than it is at this moment. And she bolts. So, she uses a love affair. Right? In other words, she walks around like a sick cat because she can't get, she has the flu, she can't get to the guy she wants to get to. And I read this thing, and I thought to myself, this is a situation worthy of Tolstoy. He could have done this, and it was worthy. And James Smiley is a very good writer. So why am I feeling this is a small good thing instead of a large thing? And it's because I said to myself, so she's going to leave David for Jerry, and she's going to move across town and marry him. And in 5 years, they're all going to be having dinner together, and you can fill in the rest of it. So I thought she was mistaken in making that. That was a metaphor that couldn't work anymore. That was not where what the age of grief was bringing to her. It was not through a new love affair that she was going to discover why her life was as small and arrested as it was. And it was from that little thing that I wrote The End of the Novel of Love and showed you cannot write a great novel anymore, a great novel, as those books were. And I don't know what the metaphors are. And in that piece, I said that once there was nature, then there was religion, then there was love. We're out of metaphors. We're on our own. And maybe we're not producing great art, great, and because that's not what we're all about. I don't know if I'm saying that, although I think it, but that's where we are.